Often, while building content for this podcast, I have interviews and topics that don't quite need a full 30 to 40 minute dedicated episode. I've decided to take these shorts and pull them together, plus offer you an update on what's in the works for the A Break in the Action podcast project. So let's get into the first ever And the Rest episode. Okay, our dove hunting season has just kicked off here. It's always fun to get out with friends and family and shoot. It hasn't been our best season in the dove fields, but great times nonetheless. With regards to shotgun hunting, I'm currently trying to settle on my next dedicated Clay's shotgun. I think I've pretty much narrowed it down to either a Blazer F3 or a Beretta DT11. Shot an F3 years back, and I sold it to get behind another K80. That was a Parkour's model. It wasn't a great gun for me, and honestly, I've really regretted selling that Blazer. I've never owned a DT11 or a DT10 for that matter, but I have shot them several times and really like the way they feel and shoot. Now moving on to podcast updates. First, let's discuss the big stuff. Many of you recognize the name Brian Robinson. Brian has been on the podcast a few times now. Lately, he's been overseas in Switzerland, France, and Italy, researching and working on a book. Brian took the opportunity to reach out to both Chapuy and Beretta to measure their interest in an on-location interview and tours of their manufacturing facilities. Both were excited to set something up. Brian has been sending me hours of audio, which I'm working my way through now. Keep listening for dedicated episodes on the shotgun makers Chapuy and Beretta. Beretta obviously needs no introduction, but some of you may not be familiar with Chapuy. Aside from just being fun to say, they make some truly beautiful over and under and side-by-side shotguns. I'm really excited to get both of these episodes out. Domestically, we've also got some interesting things planned. This December, I've been invited to shoot in the Christmas Grand Battue shoot at the wonderful Green Acres Sportsman's Club in Illinois. I've participated in this British-style-driven pheasant and flighted mallard shoot before, and to say that I'm looking forward to it is an understatement. Keith Coyle and his team masterfully plan and execute as close and an authentic English-driven day with full hospitality as you're going to find in the United States. We'll also be exploring live pigeon shooting. Well, sort of. We're going to get what I expect to be a humbling introduction to Helice by Black Prairie Helice at Prairie Wildlife in Mississippi. I've known about Helice or ZZ Bird for years, but I've never gotten a chance to try it out, so I'm really looking forward to this. I have a fun episode in the works with our good friend Johnny Carter. That'll be out in October, a Christmas gear guide, and coming in just a few weeks, we're going to do a deep dive into walnut. I also have a few episodes planned around a few shotgun-related projects. I've always been one that likes to tweak things to sometimes improve them or to make them feel more like my own. I'm in the process of making some interesting modifications to a 12-gauge Connecticut shotgun A10. This particular A10 I've labeled as my high pheasant shotgun, and it'll also do well for the Helice shooting just mentioned. These enhancements and upgrades definitely won't be for everyone, but I think you'll appreciate hearing what options are out there available to you. The second project shotgun is much more involved and will need more planning. Stay tuned for that one. Much more on that project will be announced in the next few months. So you're pretty well caught up on what's going on here. Let's now hear from my first guest, Meadow Kaufeld. With the 2023 bird season just kicking off across the country, I thought it'd be interesting to hear from a taxidermist should you finally bag that perfect bird and consider having it mounted. Meadow, you've been a guest before, and you had some really great points on the best gun for grouse episode, but go ahead and introduce yourself again and tell about all the things that you're currently involved in.
All right, Ryan. Well, my name is Meadow Kaufeld. I'm up here in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, which is kind of north central. I'm a wildlife biologist, but I also do taxidermy on the side. So, yeah, it's kind of nice to be back, and thanks for having me again.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you back. Now, you're a pretty serious hunter, too. You've just gotten back from a pretty epic adventure. Is that sort of trip usual for you?
Oh, yeah. Well, my sister and I went to New Zealand about a month and a couple weeks ago. And yeah, my sister's friends are down there, and they live on the South Island on the west coast in a town called Haast. So we were down there, did a little bit of big game hunting, and then some wing shooting.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Was that your first time hunting abroad?
It was my first time in New Zealand, but my sister and I tend to do a few international hunts. It's like once every 2 years or 3 years, we go on a big epic trip together and hunt somewhere else. So we've been to a couple different countries and continents now, and that was definitely a bucket list for me to get down there because it meets the expectation.
I bet. I bet.
Yeah.
Well, I've got you on today to talk about taxidermy and specifically game bird taxidermy. I've heard from taxidermists over the years that waterfowl and game bird taxidermy are especially challenging, and not all taxidermists will work on them. What is it that makes them harder to mount than a deer or maybe, some other mammal?
Birds in general are more difficult to do than mammals. One of the things is that I kind of liken it to you're having to build something from the foundation up. A lot of mammal taxidermists, especially folks that do deer, they're animals that are relatively consistent in their size, especially male deer, right? You can buy a form, it's a foam form, and there's a lot of options set to different dimensions on that deer. And so there really aren't that many alterations you have to make to that form, and the majority of detail and the shape is there in that form. With birds, you buy a foam body or carve a foam body, and even if you buy one, you're breaking it down so that it's small enough or large enough to fit or to match the shape of the body that you're pulling out of a bird skin. And you're building things like a neck and the legs, and then you're dealing with the head and the feet and paint. And the biggest issue is feathers and that thin skin. So most people are just not patient enough to do a bird, and it also takes another level of creativity and then also familiarity with the anatomy of birds, which is something that's a little more foreign than probably your average common big game animal.
So game birds are generally more challenging. Are there even species of game bird that or types of birds that are even harder to mount than others?
Yeah, so the most difficult birds are things like woodcock and the pigeon species, so doves. And to believe it or be honest, teal and mallard can also be really thin-skinned, but the most challenging birds are woodcock and, say, a mourning dove for a common game bird species.
Well, hopefully everyone listening will have plenty of opportunities to get out in the field this year, and then we'll be fortunate enough to bag some birds. What then makes for a good candidate for a game bird mount?
Well, the first thing obviously is condition. So, what you bring me is ground zero. I can't fix certain things or add certain things to replace damage. So, a bird that is relatively intact has few holes. A big one that I see with grouse, especially, is retrieve damage. So, a dog brings it back and you're missing a large clump of feathers. That'll alter the appearance of the mount or make it less mountable. So ultimately the condition really matters, but there is a certain amount of sentimentality with certain birds. I mean, I know I've got a lot of taxidermy, and that's part of the appeal is that it really brings back a memory or a time or maybe a dog's first retrieve or dog's last bird. There's a little bit of that, but I mean, there's only so much you can do if, you have some serious shot damage or the dog ate half of the bird. So there are some options. Some people get creative and they'll do like a head mount of a bird because that's all that's left. But but ideally that's not happening. But yeah, ultimately it's the condition. The better the bird is, the better shape the bird is in when it comes into my shop or any taxidermist shop, the higher the likelihood that the finished product is going to be nice.
That reminds me of a story. I think it was 2019 or 2020 up in Wisconsin. I made probably a lucky shot on a big mature grouse, and only minimal pellets connected with this bird. And then, uncharacteristically, the dog never found it. When I finally got my hands on it, I immediately started to plan for it to be my first ever mounted grouse. It was absolutely perfect. As I was trying to tuck the bird into the pouch of my game vest, I wasn't having a ton of luck. That's when my buddy's pointer found the bird, jumped up, took it right out of my hands, and proceeded to absolutely destroy it. So I was devastated. So it has to get to you in good shape. You can't replace what is gone. You mentioned creative things like a head mount. I haven't seen that before, but what about strategic mounts that can seal damaged areas?
Yeah. So, you know, things that we talk about, you know, that bird that lost feathers, a grouse, the problem with grouse is you can take a lot of birds in your life and really they're each one's like a fingerprint. Their color, their pattern, their size, everything's really different. So you can't replace those feathers. But if that patch of feathers was, say, on one side of the bird, we could mount it on the wall with, say, that side of the bird with that, you know, against the wall or covered by something. You know, if you look at it at the right angle, you're going to see a bald spot. But certainly I've mounted birds with one wing, taken a donor bird. Well, heads are hard, depends on the species. Heads are hard to replace because the skin on the neck is so thin. I have a spruce grouse in my shop right now that was nearly decapitated. So we were limited by the pose. So the bird's neck is scrunched down in a resting position. So there's certainly things you can do to hide it. It will not be perfect. And if you're really anal about those things, it's probably not a mount you're going to want to look at the rest of your life. But yeah, there are things that can be done if you're creative and willing to be open to allowing the taxidermist to make some creative judgments.
Well, that then brings up a good point, or maybe I guess a next good question. Is it good advice for someone to let their taxidermist weigh in on the best way to mount a bird, as opposed to someone coming in and laying out specific instructions for you to follow? I would assume that the taxidermist's artistic eye can pretty quickly recognize the best way to either conceal damage a bird might have, or maybe to kind of accentuate better features of the bird?
Yeah. I mean, that's certainly what I would recommend, is have a little flexibility, check your expectations when you bring a damaged bird in. And I'm not everybody is this way, but I'm very honest with somebody. I often tell people, I'll know when I skin it, what I can do with your bird. And so I'll take their initial desired pose and write it down. And then once I skin the bird, if it's great, I can do just about anything with it. But if it's really damaged, I'll say, well, this is the options. The other one that really is a significant factor in what the in condition of the bird looks like, or if it's mountable, is feathering. And so early season birds, especially with all these folks that are out west right now hunting prairie grouse and mountain grouses, those birds are growing feathers in. So they're pin feathered out, especially around their heads and like their flank feathers. And then if you look at their tails, they're usually growing in as well. Birds with pin feathers, especially grouse and chicken-like birds, not so much waterfowl, when they're missing those feathers or they're growing in, they look like turkey vultures when they're mounted, because that the feathers, you know, it's just like you imagine a dinosaur. You know, they look like a naked chicken sometimes, right? And if you think about it, those feathers form a contour, which is the shape that you and I are familiar with the bird's shape. And if those feathers are missing, or they're growing in, or they're short little pin feathers, that shape is not the same. And then as it dries, it becomes even more exaggerated. So having fully feathered specimens is ideal. So later in the season is even better. But yeah, I mean, some of my favorites is when somebody says, I want it flying, but that's about the only criteria they give me. They say, do what looks best. And that's when it, for me, I get more satisfaction out of it as a taxidermist, because I'm an artist. I have, you know, a certain amount of gratification that comes from being satisfied with the way something looks. One of the worst things that I get is folks will send me a picture of somebody else's taxidermy work and tell me to replicate that pose. And oftentimes I don't find it natural, or it doesn't flow quite right. And so it's frustrating for me to try and duplicate taxidermy rather than try and match or duplicate nature. And so that's one of the things, is that if you trust your taxidermist and artistic ability, is to give them a little bit of leeway within a set of parameters of what you want.
Yeah, that makes really good sense. So when a hunter actually takes a bird that he or she would like to have mounted, what immediate steps should they take in the field to protect and to transport that bird?
Situational awareness, right? So the dogs, where's your dog at? and so, you know, I totally know what you're talking about. The dog, you know, got a whiff of it and saw what you're doing and didn't get to handle the bird and was like, I'm taking that bird. Yep. And so some of the best birds that I, when I'm grouse and woodcock hunting, even pheasant hunting for this matter, not so much pheasants because the dogs don't typically miss those, but as you see, you hit a bird and you see it going down a long ways through the trees and the dogs didn't see it. I usually beeline the exact mark where I thought go and see if I can't find that bird before the dogs do. And a lot of times those birds are the perfect ones. So once you get that bird to hand, the best thing is to, I usually have a sweater or, you know, ideally you'd have a paper sack or a Ziploc bag or even a grocery sack, like a plastic grocery sack somewhere in your field vest. And is to separate that bird from the others and put it in that sack or wrap it in that t-shirt just to keep the feathers from getting broken. So if the feathers are mussed up, meaning like the Velcro-like structures separate and the feathers are separated rather than intact, that I can fix. But if they break or if they're missing, I can't fix that. So wrap that bird in that protective material and then place it on top of everything else in your field vest. And a lot of times I'll even put like a sweater underneath it and cradle it. And, you know, if you're not able to go back to the truck right away, just be really cognizant of where that bird is, and you're just going to have to be careful about putting additional birds or hulls or whatever it is that you're tossing back there so you don't mar it up. So from that point, as soon as you get back to the truck, first priority should be making sure that bird is separate still from those others or whatever else is in your vest, and cool it down right away. Because one of the issues, especially with prairie grouse and warmer weather, granted most of them are not mountable because of their feather condition, but they get hot and then they get what's called green belly. And so the enzymes and the bacteria in their gut tracts, most of these birds are herbivores or omnivorous, they have a lot of bacteria, and as soon as they die, they start to go rampant and they break loose. I'm sure you've experienced this with rough grouse. If you don't gut them right away, their guts tend to pop. And so that bacteria then starts to eat away at the skin, and that thin skin right around, right below the vent, it'll turn green and the feathers will slip or fall out. And so you'll have these large bald patches. Same thing anytime you get gut content. So if you send a BB through the intestines, that gut content will come out of that exit hole and it'll tend to slip or lose those feathers too. So you have, once again, a bald spot. So cool that bird down as fast as possible. It's late season. You can lay it in like the bed of your truck upside down so its breast is to the air and let it cool down that way. Of course, it needs to be shade and protected from other critters that might get it. But if you have an ice chest, just lay it on top of the ice, you know, and I'm a taxidermist, I'm a longtime hunter, so I'm not grossed out by things like dead birds on top of my beer, but some people are. Either way, if you really want that specimen, the number one priority should be to cool it down. And so I know I'm being long-winded, but from there, once you get to your hotel or your lodging, then you're going to be concerned about packaging it and freezing it correctly.
Okay, so speak on that just a minute. What's the best way to package the bird and then ultimately to send it off?
So the best is to have 1 or 2 gallon freezer Ziplocs. And you can get the 2 gallon ones at bigger department stores oftentimes, or order them on places like Amazon. But wet paper towels. So you saturate paper towels and you wrap them around the head and you wrap them around the feet, and then you can fold the head underneath the wing or over the back. And then you put it at the base of that Ziploc bag. And the reason I say 2 gallons is because you can put a bigger bird in there, like a full-size mallard, a big male. And then you can roll it up and squeeze the air out and seal that, put it in another one, do that again. And then I'll, later on when I get home, either masking tape or duct tape, put a couple bands around the outside, and then write your information on there, date killed, location, species. And then once you have that head and those feet wrapped in wet paper towel, and frozen. It should hold for a rather long time, you know, over a year with confidence. The reason you wrap them in wet paper towel is just to reduce that moisture loss because of the freeze-dry action, especially with most of our modern freezers, is frost-free, and so they will very quickly freeze-dry a bird if you don't wrap it up properly.
Yeah, I wondered about that. So it's basically those soft, exposed tissues like the eyes and the feet that you really need to keep an eye on and protect.
Yeah, and it's just the skin, you know, on a bird when you're mounting it. It's the first part to dry. So there's very little insulative properties, and then also just that saran wrap effect of feathers and skin. It starts to dry out, and then when the skin itself dries out, you lose elasticity. So even if I'm able to rehydrate it, it won't have as much flex, and so the end mount will be rigid, or you just won't be able to have expression in eyes, or you won't be able to taxi that skin over your foundation, the form, the same way as you would with a fresh one.
Okay, well, I think that's all really great stuff. I mean, obviously, when a hunter decides to have a bird mounted, it isn't free. It costs money, and it takes time. But those critical first few minutes and first hours, even the first few days, are really paramount to ensure the best possible mount.
Because that ultimately, you know, I can't, or anyone wouldn't be able to, you know, fix certain things that are going to happen during that time period from neglect or mishandling. I mean, most people do get lucky, but there are a few folks every year that send me birds or bring me birds that have damage that could have been prevented. And you know, it's part of the ethics of hunting too. You know, if that bird is damaged when you're trying to take extra good care of handling it, you also think about the birds that people are taking to eat, and so. Something to think about, certainly worth handling. And then the other critical factor is your taxidermist. Like you mentioned in the beginning, not many people really want to do birds or are good at birds. There are not many folks that are good at both mammals and birds. And when we talk about finances, most people do make more money doing mammals. And I'm not sure what the psychological side of that is, but people are tend to be willing to pay more for a large thing than they are for a small thing. And so a lot of taxidermists that do take birds even charge a lot of money to do, say, a woodcock, because the chances of success for mounting a woodcock are very low and they're very frustrating to work on. So there's a lot of things to take in consideration, but certainly pick your taxidermist and look at their work. It doesn't matter if they have a full-time shop. It doesn't matter if they're a guy in the basement that does 10 mounts a year. It doesn't matter. The quality of the work is through pictures and then actually physically seeing their mounts. You know, a lot of people say, well, I'll only take my bird to a world-class taxidermist. But what is a world-class taxidermist? There really isn't a status for that. And there are a lot of people that claim to be world-class taxidermists that don't do the best work. So certainly pick your taxidermist before you send your bird off, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I'll give you a shameless plug here, Meadow. I only know your work based on your website and your Instagram page. I haven't seen it in person, but it's absolutely beautiful, and it shows the level of detail that you finish these mounts to. So I'd encourage everyone to check that out. So it's time to wrap up, but I have one last question for you. What is, in all of your work, what is either a favorite species or a favorite mount that you've worked on?
You know, I like most birds, but the ones that I find the most interesting are the weird ones for the college. So I mount a lot of birds for the college. And you know, the owls, their skin is like leather. And they have like the great gray owl, for example, has up to 12-inch feathers in some parts of their body, and so they're just really forgiving and really pretty when they're done. So I really like doing owls, and honestly, I've enjoyed doing cormorants and turkey vultures. Of course, I love our game birds, but it's always fun to do something weird and off the wall.
Yeah. Well, what's the best way for those interested in working with you to contact you?
Well, if you remember my name, Meadow, Woods and Meadow Taxidermy, or Woods and Meadow LLC. Otherwise, you know, there's not too many Meadow Kalfelds in the world. So if you look for me on Instagram or Facebook or even Google me, you should be able to find me fairly easily.
I think we can wrap it up from there. Meadow, thanks for all the great information.
Awesome. Sounds good, Ryan. Thank you.
A few weeks ago, I received another shotgun for review. This time, it was a Zoli Pernice round body over and under. The specs of the model I received are a 20 gauge with 30 inch barrels. Speaking of the barrels, straight off, that's one of my favorite aspects of this shotgun. The Zoli Pernice comes standard with a solid middle and top rib. I get it that venting the ribs between the barrels and the top rib allows for better heat dissipation. I get that. But there's not a more classic profile to an over and under shotgun than one that sports solid ribs. The receiver is a box lock design with the typical Italian style low set barrels. The round body receiver boasts full coverage acanthus and vine style engraving that, although done by laser, is deep and interesting. The Pernice has a fantastically crisp trigger with a removable trigger group for cleaning and service. It isn't quite as easy to remove as a Perazzi or a Beretta DT10 or 11, but it's doable if needed. The stock meets the receiver at pleasant contoured lines. There are no harsh angles. It's apparent that the Pernice was built to follow a very well thought out and cohesive design. Lines are smooth and contoured to accentuate the round bodied receiver. My Pernice has nice wood, not amazing wood, but nice wood. The stock has the dimensions of a modern sporter with a flat, high comb. The Pernice is a bit more hand filling than some other Italian over and unders, especially in the fore end. Zoli picked another of my all-time favorite characteristics for the Pernice by going with a shallow, swept-back pistol grip. To me, it's something between a Woodward style and a Prince of Wales style grip. I love how these feel in hand, and it's a wonderful complement to the overall style. Checkering is done by laser, but Zoli has abandoned the typical angular checkering panels and gone with something that, again, complements the overall good looks of this shotgun with sweeping curves and contours. I'd say that it's both traditional and modern, if that's possible, and of course, it functions perfectly. The third of my favorite features that Zoli has built into the Pernice is the Anson-style pushrod fore-end release. It functions no better than the conventional Dealey lever, but I think the result is a little bit more refined. I was fortunate to get the Pernice right in time for our opening of dove season. While this wasn't our most productive dove opener, I did get to shoot it quite a bit. Long-barreled game guns are in vogue right now, and the 30-inch set on my test gun were just about right. Remember that chunkier fore-end I mentioned? I didn't think that I'd like it, but I really did. It had the same sort of hand-filling control that a target gun would have. Again, I think Zoli really did their homework here and designed exactly what we see in the Pernice. There were no accidents. I'm sure this would also be a dynamite option for quail. All of my other outings with the Pernice were either for sporting clays or a few random rounds of skeet. This is where things for me really went south. This is a field gun, and despite the hand-filling fore-end, I had a terrible time just trying to be mediocre with it on clays. The narrow to even narrower tapered rib distracted me on clay targets. I know you're not even supposed to notice it, but it sets high off the top barrel, and it's extremely, extremely narrow. My calipers measured the rib at 4 millimeters at the muzzle. I've shot everything from an extra-wide tramline rib to ribless designs. This 11mm to 4mm taper for some reason really distracted me. Maybe I just got it in my head and couldn't shake it. Something that a little bit more time with the gun would have worked itself out, but this was a real issue for me. That being said, I didn't even notice it in the dove fields. An afternoon of sporting clays made it clear that its 6-pound, 9-ounce weight won't do the recoil sensitive any favors. Again, this is a game gun, and I don't think that buying it for regular target shooting makes much sense. When it comes to competitive options, there are a few in this $6,000 to $7,500 price range. A close cousin to the Pernice is the Rizzini Roundbody EM. These share a similar look, but frankly, I think where initial design choices could have been made one way or the other, Rizzini went with the predictable and common, whereas Zoli gave us more class and that little bit extra. To be fair, a Rizzini is noticeably less expensive. I've owned two Rizzini Roundbody EMs and sold them both. Sort of good from afar, but far from good on each case. Plus, I just absolutely cannot bring myself to like a round knob pistol grip. An even more interesting option in this price range is the legendary Beretta 687 EELL. I'm an especially big fan of the fully engraved examples from the mid to later 90s. They're still box locks, but the side plates really do well to dress them up. With regards to price, the Pernice also sits right in the middle of the Connecticut shotgun manufacturing Inverness, a round-bodied box lock, and their Sidelock Model A10. Comparing to shotguns I own currently, would I trade up or down the Pernice for either of my A10s or Invernesses? I don't think so. It's close, and I like things about the Pernice, but I don't think that it's perfect for me. And frankly, I feel like the Inverness represents a similarly spec'd shotgun at a better buy. In summary, this $6,000 to $7,500 range for a premium, top-tier field gun is crowded, and there's some really strong competition. With the Pernice, Zoli has taken the reliable Italian-designed box lock and refined it, knocking off corners and smoothing out edges. The Pernice is an exceptional blend of Italian craftsmanship, innovation, and performance, and it does stand out. My advice to you, sadly, is the same as I typically always offer. Find a place where you can get your hands on one, and even better, find a place where you can shoot one. Next up, it's been a while since we had a book review on the podcast, so this is something I've really been looking forward to. If you're like me, you don't get nearly as much time in the field as you wish you did. Life is busy, and sometimes, unfairly, it's even busy during hunting season. Always having a good book around is nice. When the story focuses on or even mentions shotguns, bird dogs, and wing shooting, it's even better. Gene Hill, Burton Spiller, Robert Roark, and Mike Gaddis are a few of my favorite authors, and of course, the legendary Ben O. Williams. It was a short piece that Ben contributed in the new book Mouthful of Feathers, Upland in America, that put it on my radar. My next guest, Tom Reed, helped make this book a reality. Tom, go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us about the role you played in bringing A Mouthful of Tail Feathers, Upland in America, to life.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely.
To start with, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm an author. I live in Montana. I've been at this game for many, many years, and I've also been involved with this blog that was called Mouthful of Feathers, and we had that blog going for, and we still have it going partially, you know, it's kind of an off and on thing, but for probably 10 or 15 years, way back when blogs were kind of the in thing to do, and it really, we got kind of a little cult following, and then we decided, well, shoot, let's just take this to where, you know, just a few of us that were in the upland hunting game could write something that maybe a traditional publication would say, oh, it's too edgy or, you know, not quite suitable for their market. You know, it might have had some, you know, irreverent language that maybe was offensive to their readers or whatever. And so the blog really was just kind of a place where writers that were stretching themselves a little bit, wanting to do something a little different, could get something published. And the only prerequisite was really you had to be real and you had to be an upland hunter. And then you also had to be a good writer. And so we started the blog and there was only about four or five of us. And then it evolved into an ebook, which we sold for a little while. And it basically was enough to essentially maybe fund one tank of fuel and maybe a, you know, a case of beer for us or something like that. But, you know, which was great. That was fine. But it got such a kind of a, you know, we got such nice feedback from the readers that we decided maybe we should do something, that you could hold in your hands. And that evolved into, this recent project that came out. It's called A Mouthful of Feathers, Upland in America. And we just published it, and it's an anthology, and we put together, I think 20 writers to write us the foreword, you know, a lot of us that originated the blog were able to get some stories in there, and then we got a hold of folks that we really liked that had a presence out there and talked to them about being part of it, too, and we just got a great reception for it, and we bootstrapped it ourselves. And I was one of three editors, Reed Bryant, who is an excellent writer from Vermont, and my friend Greg McReynolds, who's an excellent writer from Pocatello, Idaho, and then myself from Pony, Montana. we were the three editors on it, and we put her together and kind of self-published the thing, and we're pretty proud of it.
Yeah, you really should be. You'd think that having that many voices, you mentioned like 20 writers and each with a unique style, that it might be tough to read or it might seem fractured, but it really has a nice continuity throughout the book. It's filled with everything from poems to short stories to kind of essays. Do you recall how large the pool of material that you originally had to work with was?
Well, it went on for it's gone on for years and years. And so one thing that we told our authors is, hey, you know what? Send us something that maybe got rejected from a magazine that they felt was too edgy for them, or send us something that was already been published in a magazine. That's all fine. And then a couple were just from the blog. But, there's some original, quite a bit of original material in this book. The blog itself, went on over, 10 or 15 years, and it's pretty extensive. If you get into mouthfulofeathers.com, you can do quite a bit of reading. There's a lot of material on there.
I love that when you look over the table of contents, some of the contributing authors are really well known. Names like Benno Williams, and we already mentioned Reed Bryant, who's just an awesome storyteller. And you even have a foreword written by Beetlejuice himself. That would be the acclaimed actor Michael Keaton. But then beyond those names, it introduced me to content from less recognizable names. Men and women who obviously hunt, love dogs, good dog work, and have a deep appreciation for the birds that we pursue and the lands that we chase them on.
Yeah, there's a lot of, the commonality, I think, is we wanted writers that could put together a story, and some of the writers we discovered, they have their own kind of, Instagram or Facebook following, and others, were folks that we'd known for years. And like I say, there's published writers, Greg, myself, and Reed, have been published pretty extensively. Chris Dombrowski, Christine Peterson, Jillian Lukuski, those are all writers that you've seen around. And of course, Benno Williams, who's in his 90s, and you've seen his stuff for years. We felt it was kind of appropriate to have him in there too, because, this book is almost a baton passing in a lot of ways. We really didn't feel that there's that many upland writers out there that are, Eddie Nickens is another one that's very well known. He's in the book. We didn't feel that there's a huge pool of writers out there that were carrying the tradition on forward. And so we kind of went out and found them and tried to put them together in all one place.
Yeah, I think you guys did a really great job.
Thank you.
I asked you in advance if you'd mind if I read this quick excerpt from the introduction. I think that this really does well to sum up what is in the pages that follow. The writers of this book are spread across the country. They are authors new and old. Their backgrounds are different and their worldviews are disparate. Each of them understands the wonder of a wild bird, the allure of a secret place, and the love of a dog. This is the place where we put aside differences and walk on common ground, sharing common joy. This is the place for uplanders, dog lovers, and fans of the well-crafted sentence. The only right and left in this book is the right side of the canyon or the left side of the wheat field. Conservative is what you are when you're low on shells and you're a mile from the truck. Liberal describes your pour from the bourbon bottle at the end of the day. Here we set aside sides and we hunt, brag on our bird dogs, celebrate stories, and hopefully enjoy. Tom, do you have anything you want to add to sum this book up?
No, I just think, we're really excited, that is, five women in there. There's just a diverse slate of authors that we're really proud of. And, and it's a book that folks can go on Amazon and find, Mouthful of Feathers, Upland and American. And I think, and it's stories, you don't have to have a, it's not a 500 page novel that you have to, remember where you were in the story and where you left off. It's,
Right.
short stories that you could put down and pick back up a month later after you've read one and continue on your busy life.
Do you have any plans for a sequel or a second edition?
Well, we'll see how this one does, financially. Right now we're just trying to sell some books and get our money back. We're just we're we'll see what the reception is, and hopefully there'll be a sequel. It'd be certainly fun to do one.
Tom, thanks for your time tonight.
All right, thanks, Ryan. I really appreciate it. Bye.
Tom and I fought with a few connection and technical issues on our call, but I think he still did a good job introducing the book. It really is a great read, and I'd encourage everyone to get a copy. Tom was generous enough to not only send me a copy, but also another to offer to one of our listeners, so we've got a giveaway. Entering is super easy. Just go to the latest post on our Instagram feed, make sure you're following. Like the post showing the Mouthful of Feathers book and tag a friend in the comments who you think might enjoy the podcast. I'll draw a winner and get the book and some extras headed his or her way. And finally, back in 2010, I attended something called a hunt ball, a celebration at the conclusion of the hunting seasons with great friends, wonderful food and drinks, and plenty of embellished stories. There was a chance that I was going to be asked to bless the meal before we began. Not wanting to wing it, I thought quite a bit about what I'd say. The night was fantastic, but I was never asked to bless the meal. Now, I'm no writer and I'm certainly no poet, but I hope you'll indulge me as I archive what I came up with on this podcast. So here it is, presented by the official voice of the A Break in the Action intro, Mr. T.K. Kilman.
A Hunter's Prayer for the cunning of the fox and the obsession of the hound. The majesty of the white-tailed deer, and the frost upon the ground. For humbling shots at dove and teal, and their acrobatics on the wing. The exhilaration of bringing trout to hand, and the satisfaction that it brings. For the patience spent with stalking glass, o'er thistled hills for stag, the hard-earned hare, the cock, the squirrel, a simple man's mixed bag. For the explosion of colors in the spring, and winter's steely grays, the rusts of autumn, harvest golds, and summer's steamy haze. For calming evenings spent by campfire, and the intoxicating walks that fill our days. There are no greater gifts than these. Almighty Father, we give you praise.
That'll do it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to enter the Mouthful of Feathers giveaway. I've got much more in the works, so keep listening and tell a friend or hunting buddy about the show. And until next time,
we hope you have enjoyed this episode of A Break in the Action. Want to hear your voice on a future episode? Leave a message, ask a question, or suggest a topic on our listener line at 317-662-4520. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook, and visit us at abreakintheaction.com.